The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Striking down some of the nation's strictest gun laws, the court emphasized the Second Amendment is not a second-class right. Writing for the 6-3 majority, Justice Clarence Thomas said concealed carry laws in New York and at least five other states prevent law-abiding citizens with ordinary self-defense needs from exercising their right to keep and bear arms. New York officials characterized the ruling as a blow to public safety.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today. We're hearing in the blurb there about gun rights. We're going to be talking a little bit about the Bruin case here at the bottom of the hour with Josh Blackman from Volokh Conspiracy at Reason.com. And we're going to be talking about a lot of the different Supreme Court stories that came out, what we can kind of thread together from them. And it's going to be a really interesting conversation. But equally interesting, if not more, is my friend King Banyan, who is going to talk to us today about the economy. Where are we actually in a recession now? Is this, can we expect one? You can find out more from King Banyan. He's on KYCR in Minneapolis, the Dean of the School of Public Affairs at St. Cloud State University, and he's here with us right now. King, welcome back.
Hey, Ed, good to speak with you again. How's everything going today?
It is going well. I believe that we're not quite in a recession yet, so that's all right. I think it's probably likely that one's coming, but I am seeing reporting that some people saying, well, we're in a recession. We're already in a recession. And I would say that, first off, we probably need to define the terms because this is going to become important. It's been a while at least since we've had to worry about what the actual definition of a recession is. This is probably a good time for us to go over that.
Well, it's interesting. We're going to have this conversation again because back in 2020, of course, we had a serious collapse of economic activity, and a recession means that you've gone from a peak where you've had this increase in output and in employment, and those numbers typically move upward. They go up more often than they go down, but you hit a peak and then you get a drop. Now, the classic definition that many of your listeners will know is that is a two consecutive quarters of declining GDP means a recession. That's a definition many people use, but that's not the quote-unquote official definition. And the problem, because if you take that recession in 2020, it really only lasted 2 months, according to the people that put the dates on it. And that's
right.
I wouldn't call it really a public organization, but it's the National Bureau for Economic Research. And they started it in February of 2020 and ended it in April of 2020. So there was never an opportunity to say it started this quarter, ended this quarter, and so forth. You didn't get the two negative numbers in a row, until much, much later. But we really said that that recession only lasted so long. So when people say, are we in a recession right now, I say, you know what, employment's still at an all-time high. The unemployment rate is below 4%. It is really hard for us to say we're in a recession until we start seeing some increase in unemployment, even if I do see GDP decline in the second quarter as it did in the first quarter. I think you would still be hard-pressed to say there's a recession until you see industrial production go down, until you see employment go down, until you see retail sales go down, until those numbers decline. I don't think you're really going to be able to put a date on a recession starting.
You know, it's interesting too, because you mentioned about two quarters of declining GDP. We actually had a quarter of declining GDP. The first quarter you had, I think it was a minus 1.5% annualized GDP. But even then, and I've been kind of cautioning people who have been talking about recession, that wasn't really a classic decline. You had consumer spending going up. You still had business investment actually went up in that. It was really the result of a huge trade imbalance that took place in the first quarter. I'm not sure what the structure of that was that really tipped it over into negative territory. But everything else structurally in that was still showing growth. And so I'm not even sure that qualifies. I mean, it does in the popular sense of a recession. And if you get a second quarter here, which I think is going to be I think those fundamentals are going to be a little worse in Q2 just based on what some of the, you know, intermediate reports have been. But you're going to have people say, well, look, it's a recession. And I'm still going to point back to that first quarter and say, that wasn't really a recessionary quarter in the first quarter. Only in the trade imbalance was it really a recessionary quarter.
Right. So you had two things happen, right? You had a trade imbalance, but that was triggered by something else, which was triggered by a third thing. The second thing was, of course, we ran down inventories. And when you actually disinvest in the inventory stock, you will see a decline in GDP as a result of that. So that was there as well. What triggered both of those things? The fact that we had people out of work due to the Omicron wave. So you had people who would disappear. I mean, they weren't gone for weeks and weeks, but they were gone for maybe, you know, 10 days or so. And so in order to meet the demand for your goods, and everyone's still got a big pile of money in their pocket, all this extra savings from the various stimulus bills from 2020 and 2021, all those goods were being purchased with, you know, being purchased from international sources or bought out of inventories because domestic producers could not produce in the beginning of 2022 because of Omicron and because of some supply chain issues that they're experiencing as well.
Right. So, I mean, it's important when you're looking at these, it's not just the top line numbers that you need to be looking at, right? And this is the reason why we're talking with King Banyan, who's, you know, who's an expert on these things. And also, he's just really great on the radio. So it's always great to talk with you. And again, you're on KYCR in Minneapolis. You talk about these issues every week on Saturday mornings. And so just the nature
of
9 to 11 a.m. Central Time, if you want to tune that in. So, King, looking at some, you know, putting aside the first quarter, looking at some of the numbers that we're getting out of the second quarter, we saw consumer spending sort of spike a little bit again in April and then really drop in May. And these were numbers that aren't inflation adjusted, which means that it's probably worse than what they look like, right? We haven't seen, obviously, we haven't seen anything in June because June's not over with yet. But you see some talk about how the Atlanta Fed's tracking numbers sort of tipped over to zero and that sort of thing. I mean, are we seeing a slowdown in the of a type that would indicate a recession is coming?
I don't think a slowdown that indicates a recession is coming would be too strong. Has there been a slowdown in the level? Certainly production has increased. We saw a pretty good durable goods number just yesterday. And
right.
So I believe that for May. So I actually think the May numbers when they're all in, we're getting close to the end, but when we have all the May numbers in, I suspect we'll end up saying that May was an okay month. April was a little stronger than that. So the real question is, what's happening in June? Has the increases in prices that people are experiencing actually caused consumers to pull back? So the things I'm really looking for, Ed, over the next few weeks is going to be information on retail sales. What's happening in the grocery store? What's happening at the big box retailer? I know. Are you buying furniture? What's happening to auto sales? Those are the things that I think will tell us whether or not that number comes in positive or negative. Because I know the Atlanta Fed tracking number actually ticked up now to 0.3%, 0.3%, but it's really still sluggish, obviously. But all of the private forecasters that are out there have been projecting something closer to 2 to 2.5%, and I think that's pretty much where my head is at as well.
Interesting. Okay, so one of the other things that we've been hearing, based on, I believe, just quarterly reports from some of the big box retailers that you're talking about, Walmart and Target especially, right, are saying, look, our customers are really scaling down. They're opting more for generics and really staying away from name brands. At the same time, though, what you're hearing from some of the larger upscale retailers. Is that their customers are actually spending more money, and they're buying more goods, and they're not scaling down at all. So, Heather Long over at the Washington Post was writing about this, and I believe it was about 3 weeks ago that she was writing about this. This came out, I believe, toward the end of May, and or the beginning of this month, and she was talking about it starting to appear that we're sort of diverging into a have and have not economy rather than one where spending is more or less at least the pattern of spending is more or less similar across, you know, various different income groups. Are you seeing something similar to that? And what would that tell us about what might be coming down the road?
Yeah, I read that piece by Heather Long, and I think that fits what I'm hearing as well. That those who are in, say, professional businesses and those at upper income levels have been doing fairly well over the last, pretty much cruised through the COVID recession, and are doing fine. And so those numbers have actually looked better than the numbers, say, for a Walmart or Target or such, Costco. Those numbers have come down. They're a little bit challenged, and that's largely the reaction to price, people switching out to other brands. So I think everything right. You said about that is correct. But when you're trying to measure what GDP is doing, I think the one thing to really watch here is that the beginning of the COVID recession, we flipped a switch. Nobody could buy services. Everybody bought goods. And so you saw a big increase in goods price inflation, right? And that went up. Now that's beginning to drift back down. But at the same time, all of that income has been pushed into bidding up services. And the place where I'm also watching for that impact is keep an eye on what's happening with rents. You know, what are people paying in rent? Is the rent at the apartment building down the street or your apartment, is that going up in price or going up in price as rapidly as houses have gone up? Because the Costcos and Walmarts are going to dry up their sales to the extent that you have to put more money into the rent payment every month instead. And that's where I see it happening. If it's going to happen, I think you're describing maybe the start of this process, but I think it's still got 6 to 12 months to run to see all of the impact on rents that we're paying for apartments.
Well, that's going to bring us to the inflation question and the Federal Reserve. We're speaking with King Banyan and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And, I mean, this is part of what the Federal Reserve is trying to calculate, right? The mythical soft landing where you can stop inflation without triggering a recession. And theoretically, it's possible. Has it ever been accomplished, I guess, would be my first question.
Hey, well, not to the extent that it is here. So people will point to a period in 1994 where the Fed under Alan Greenspan actually started to raise rates in late 1994 and managed to bring rates up and lower what they saw to be incipient inflation in 94 without causing a recession. There was no recession between 1990 and 2000. However, the inflation rate at that time was about 3.5%, and they were trying to get back to 2%. It wasn't at 8%. The fact right. that the Fed waited so long to start the process of raising rates, of starting the process to ending quantitative easing, means that they kind of have to hit the brakes faster. So it's sort of like you do a soft landing. I might be able to soft land, you know, if the car's going 20 miles an hour, but if the car's going 50 and I'm approaching the wall, I'm not sure the brakes work that well and are going to stop the car fast enough without actually causing a recession. I think we're going to be with a positive GDP number in the second quarter. But most economists, and I'd put myself in this camp, kind of look at 2023 and say, boy, it's kind of hard to see how we're going to avoid one at that time. And it's because I think the Fed is going to have to move rates significantly higher, more than I think they've indicated to us so far.
Normally speaking, right? I mean, and this is one of those normally speaking questions, King, and I completely grant this because there's probably not really a pattern for this, but I've heard it said that the rule of thumb is that your interest rate is going to have to get at least to where your inflation rate is to even start having an impact on this, right? So if your
yes.
inflation rate's at 8.6% and you're still at, I'm not even sure where we're at right now, 1.75? I think is the basis rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's still a big, huge gap. And I know that they're signaling more of these interest rate hikes down the road. But, I mean, at this rate of correction, just back to your point about the car and the brakes, they're not really stomping on the brake, right? They're just kind of starting to toe the pedal here a little bit to see what the response is.
Right. I think they're feathering it a little bit. I mean, part of this is because of the quantitative easing. They know they've got to run off the portfolio, and they're afraid. I mean, they've had a couple episodes over the last 5 years where all of a sudden the Treasury market got a little jittery. That's supposed to be a very liquid market, and it's supposed to behave very, very normally. It's had a couple periods in the last 5 years where it's not behaved normally, and there's some concern in the Fed about that. So that's why I think they're kind of trying to go a little bit slow. I don't think it's just they're wanting to inflate the economy and so forth. And I don't think it's necessarily all to do with looking at what Congress might say about triggering a recession. I think they really are worried about financial markets. But you're right to this extent, Ed. If you are going to try to stop this recession, stop the inflation, I wouldn't use the 8.6 as the number, but if you look at that core personal consumption number that they look at, they're currently at about 6.5%, and they don't believe it's going to get down below 4%, you know, anytime by the end of this year. You have to get that Fed funds rate up from 3.5%, where everyone thinks it's going to be at the end of the year. It has to go above 4%. Or else you actually won't be putting any drag on that inflation number to bring it back toward 2%.
We're speaking with King Banyan and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. And we do have a caller, Sam in Athens, Georgia, would like to join the conversation. Sam, welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking my call. I have a question about the housing market. It was so hot here, you could list a house and sell it the same day until 2 weeks ago. Now you can't give a house away. What happened?
Sam, great question.
Well, yeah, it's a great question, and the short answer is mortgage rates moved up. We had mortgages in the mid-3s as recently as 90 days ago. And now the last number I saw was about a 6% mortgage, 5.98 last week from the Mortgage Bankers Association. And so the house that you were putting on the market was going so fast, people started to mark up their houses because they're like, I want to make sure I get a good price for my house. I don't want to sell it too fast because you think, shoot, I might have left some money on the table. And people were doing that at the same time the rate's going up and the number of people who could qualify to buy your house is going down. So as a result of that, I do think some of that market is dried up. The other thing to think about is the fact that because of the supply chain issues, there were a number of new houses that were out there in production. They were in under construction, but not done yet. And all of a sudden, we've seen some bettering of that supply condition. Things are getting a little better there. And as a result of that, more new houses are getting onto the market. And that's actually also causing prices to move back down because of course, they add to the supply that's out there.
They add to the supply. They also compete against the pre-existing home market, too. I mean, that's
correct.
Yeah, I mean, buyers probably naturally will gravitate towards the newer builds, assuming that the dollar values are the prices are relatively the same. And so that will kind of force a downward pressure on the price of existing home sales. And I saw something, I think it was today or late yesterday, that that number came in, I think, better than they expected it to be. But that's, again, something to keep an eye on because, this is a fairly simple mechanism here. If you're going to raise interest rates that much, you're going to get that reaction in mortgage rates, and that's just simply going to price people out of houses. You go from, what was it you said, about just the upper 3s, I think, right, to almost 6%.
Yep.
I mean, that's 2 points on a mortgage. You're talking several $100 a month difference in terms of what the house payment is going to be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's actually so when you hear people talk about raising rates, you'll sometimes hear the phrase even from Fed officials about demand destruction. Part of the demand we're destroying is the demand for housing. And you know, that's a feature, not a flaw in the Fed's policy. I mean, they actually do want to cool that market somewhat, and likewise with stocks. But I think cooling the housing market. It was very interesting, Ed. I don't know if you watched Jay Powell's press conferences. The last question he was asked is almost identical to the question your caller asked about what's going on with the housing market. And he started to say, "Hey, if you're putting your house on the market and you think you get a high price, you might need to rethink your expectations." And it was almost like you could see the lights going on, like, "Whoops! I'm going down a bad road." And the answer ended very quickly after that. If you read the last three paragraphs of the transcript from that press conference, it's really fascinating to watch him hit reverse really fast on what he was saying.
Well, he's hitting reverse on what he's saying, but they're not going to hit reverse on the policy. They're going to continue to increase interest rates because they have to. He just got done explaining why they have to in order to cool inflation off. And so this is going to continue to be a problem in the markets because those mortgage rates are going to keep going up. They're going to basically index off of the Federal Reserve rate. That's what they do anyway, and that's going to create even more slowdowns, and with it, less money in terms of cash available on hand for consumers to spend. Because a lot of people they buy a house. They sell their house to get some cash out of it and buy something else. Maybe they're moving to a market where the property values are lower so they can get some cash out. They can spend some money. That probably is going to dry up as well. And that, with it, the secondary economic activity that goes along with it.
Yeah. What we need to see, I mean, to go back to that phrase, demand destruction, what we need to see is that the savings bubble that was created by fiscal policy in 2020 and 2021, we sort of need to see that being taken out of the marketplace. And some of that, and so there's a phrase we use sometimes, the cure for high prices is high prices. and that applies here. Is that price goes up, some of what you can afford to buy is going to go down. But there's still this sort of this pent-up demand for, particularly if I think about traveling, you look at what's happening to the price of your airline ticket right now, or look at the price you're having to pay for a hotel or for a rental car or something like that. A lot of that were things that we simply couldn't do in 2020 or 2021, or most of us thought we couldn't do. And now we're like, I don't really care what it costs. My family has been on vacation in 3 years, full speed ahead. They might choose to shorten up their vacation by a night. They might go to someplace a little closer, but they're still going to go. They're still going to buy the gas, and they're still going to get on the airplane. And it's going to be a while before those prices come back down.
Well, that's something to keep an eye on, and it's going to be a while before the inflation starts to meter out too, which is going to impact the buying power of people who are trying to buy those goods, King. And I'll just give you 30 seconds to give us your projection on inflation here.
Well, I don't see inflation coming down below 4.5% anytime this year on a year-over-year basis, particularly even on the Fed's preferred measure. I don't think they get down below 4, that personal consumption piece. I think the one thing to watch right now is what happens to the price of oil. If it does, if we see a recession, that price of oil comes back down to like $85 or $80 a barrel. Price of your gallon of gas drops back down below $4. That's good news. It'll bring down inflation, but that means that, therefore, that I think that the recession will be worse than we think and will come sooner than I think. So I don't think the recession is coming in 2022, so I still think inflation is going to be pretty high at the end of this year.
King Banyan, Dean of the School of Public Affairs at St. Cloud State University. He's on KYCR in Minneapolis. Be sure to tune in there for his wisdom on Saturday mornings, 9 to 11 Central Time. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's been going on at the Supreme Court. Are there threads that we can tie together? We're going to be talking with Josh Blackman about that. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
You know, we receive over 1 million prayer requests every year, thanks in part to the Catholic Order of Foresters Studio Line, helping us stay connected to your intentions. Learn how our sponsor can support your family with life insurance at relevantradio.com/Forrester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society. Not available in all states.
The truth.
Thanks, Drew. Always a quest for the truth.
Now.
And it just reinforced why I love Relevant Radio, because you guys got the truth.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 31 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Coming up at the top of the hour, the Cale Clark Show. Topic today is going to be gas station screens and our distracted souls, plus how Jesus defeated Satan fair and square. That's going to be an awesome show, by the way. So be sure to stay tuned in at the top of the hour. Cale Clark Show coming up after this show. And joining us right now to talk a little bit about what's been going on over the last few days, the busy season for Josh Blackman of Reason.com's Volokh Conspiracy. Josh Blackman is a constitutional law professor at the South Texas College of Law, Houston, an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and president of the Harlan Institute. Josh, great to talk to you again. Glad I could pry you away from the prolific work you're doing over at Volokh Conspiracy the last few days, going over all of these Supreme Court decisions.
Well, thank you for having me.
So there's a number of these decisions that we're going to step through here, and especially I want to talk about a little bit about Bruin. But is there a theme or a thread that's going through some of these major decisions that have been coming down the last few days? Are you sensing that there's some sort of a pattern developing here that will sort of give us a sense of a philosophy that might be forming in this version of the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that the new court, this new conservative court, is sort of flexing its muscles. And it's saying that there's a lot of old precedent that was wrongly decided, and we're going to push it away, kind of like clearing the brush. And this is the first term where you're really seeing this in case after case, the court's majority is saying no to these old decisions.
Well, and Roe being, of course, the most obvious of these, right? I mean, this was not an unanticipated outcome when they took on Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Clinic they took it on, I think, at the beginning of the session, and they had the oral arguments, I believe, in November or December. I don't think anybody mm-hmm. really thought that this was going to come out a whole lot different than what it did. And of course, we had the leak in May of Alito's opinion. And I think the only thing that was surprising in the end was that that opinion did not change much except to address the dissents that took place. And it also changed to address the sort of kind of concurrence that Chief Justice Roberts wrote, which was really interesting. That part was very interesting. The Roberts semi-concurrence and Alito's response to it.
Well, I'll tell you, Ed, until the very end, I wasn't certain what was going to happen. Conservatives have gotten burned so many times before in the Supreme Court that until I saw the opinion in print, I didn't believe it. Then we saw it, and it was done. But the five members of the majority held strong. They didn't vacillate. They didn't depart. And the court emphatically and clearly overruled Roe versus Wade. I didn't think it was possible. For 50 years, it survived, and I didn't think this day would ever come.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I was skeptical about it myself when we were confirming Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, and we were confirming Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. I mean, certainly that was a good step in the right direction. I was happy with those nominations, even apart from whatever might happen with Roe. But I was skeptical that it was actually going to get to that point, because I saw Kavanaugh more as an institutionalist, not in a bad way. I don't mean that in a bad way at all, but I saw him more as an institutionalist. I saw Amy Coney Barrett as somebody who might be her instincts might run in that same direction. And so, yes, I was thinking that you might end up getting something like what Robert suggested, which was this idea that you could uphold the law in Mississippi without striking down Roe. You'd have to strike down Casey. You'd probably have to maybe sort of strike down Doe, too. And you'd have to certainly rework Roe. And I actually was expecting that to be the outcome. I thought that the draft was just more or less going to be it was more or less a proposal to, you know, for Roberts then to try to work his magic, so to speak. And apparently that's what he wanted to do, but it didn't work. Nobody was buying it.
Right. I mean, I still think that Kavanaugh has a strong institutional streak, and Barrett may as well. I'm not certain. But for whatever reason, we can speculate, they both saw this case as different. That to sort of squish, as they say, on abortion would be a bridge too far. The Chief Justice, and I'll describe his opinion in a moment, he said that we don't need to overrule Roe v. Wade. All we need to say is that we'll modify it, right? And here's Roberts' reasoning. The average woman finds out she's pregnant around 6 weeks. Mississippi banned abortion at 15 weeks. Therefore, in theory, women have 9 or 10 weeks after they learn of their pregnancy to have an abortion. Roberts says that's plenty of time. So Roberts would remove the line of viability, right? It doesn't matter whether the fetus is viable.
Right.
Doesn't matter what trimester you're in. All that matters is you've had some reasonable opportunity to have an abortion. Presumably 6 weeks is too early. That's what Texas had. Conception, which would be 0 weeks, would be even way too early because people don't know they're pregnant. But the problem is, where the hell does Roberts get this from, right? How does he know that you need some reasonable opportunity to have an abortion? Doesn't that presume this right exists in the first place? And I have to imagine Brett Kavanaugh read this opinion, and Amy Coney Barrett read it and said, is this the best you got? Is this it? Is this what's supposed to sort of change our mind? And at the end of the day, they said, we're not persuaded. Alito has a better argument. We'll join his opinion.
Well, and I think he does. I mean, I was sort of having fun a little bit over the weekend by either the weekend or may have even been yesterday. I was joking around that I was about to write the most arrogant tweet I'd ever written because I was writing this big lengthy look at Alan Dershowitz's argument that Roberts was right because the Supreme Court shouldn't have decided the question of Roe because that question wasn't before them in this case, and that you could have done this without disturbing Roe. So I wrote this big, long analysis of all of this, but the tweet went out, and I said, Alan Dershowitz is wrong, and I'm right. And so maybe is Alito, but mostly me. And, you know, as a joke, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, just sort of a fun thing. But, I mean, honestly, I mean, I think that as much as I respect Alan Dershowitz's, you know, legal insight, it really did – Roberts and by extension here, Dershowitz, missed the point that in order to get around – Roe, you'd have to remove the viability part, which is thoroughly in Roe, right? The whole idea of viability is there's at least 9 points where they make about viability being the issue in Roe. You'd have to remove that, and if you're going to remove that, what's the point of keeping Roe in place? You're dismantling it one way or the other, and for what? And so that you can do this again, as Robert said, well, we can do it again with the next case. And I'm sure this didn't actually factor into the actual decision, but I mean, any normal person looking at what happened in the reaction after the leak went out in early May mm-hmm. saying, oh yeah, well, we can always do this again. I mean, the justices are really, I mean, I'm sure that they have a high degree of integrity and they're really working on what they think is best. But I mean, as a person, you have to look at that and say, why would we want to do that again? We've got it in front of us. Both sides said that you have to make a decision one way or the other on this. Let's get it done. Let's get it over with.
I think that's right. You know, the Roberts approach is you keep kicking the can down the road, and the road never ends. The can just goes eventually, right? You never actually go anywhere. You simply just keep on the journey for years and years at a time. But at bottom, no one else is persuaded. Roberts cannot persuade Barrett. Roberts cannot persuade Kavanaugh. And none of the liberals bother joining it to try and give it more credibility. So, you know, as the song goes, the chief stands alone, or the chief stands alone, I suppose.
Right. Again, we're speaking with Josh Blackman of Reason.com's Vola Conspiracy, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Just briefly, what was your assessment of the dissenting opinion? First off, I was surprised there was only one. I thought this was an opportunity for all three justices to have their own say. Instead, they just really combined up on one dissent. I'm curious as to what you took away from that, because, well, I'll let you go first, and I'll tell you what I thought.
Right. The three liberals, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, wrote what's called a joint dissent, where they all wrote it together. And it showed. It was long. And I thought it was a little bit repetitive. It kind of made the same points over and over again. It really read like you have three separate opinions. They sort of just copy and paste it together. you know, most of the arguments in defense of Roe and Casey are not that the cases were correctly decided. There's very little argument right. they were. Right? These opinions were written out of thin air. Instead, the argument is, well, if you get rid of Roe and Casey, what about gay marriage? What about contraception? What about all these other cases? And, oh, by the way, if you get rid of Roe and Casey, the courts become very unpopular and people aren't going to be happy, and that judges should write rulings to make, you know, to avoid controversy. The majority emphatically rejects those both arguments. The court says we should not care what people think. We make our decision by our best light, come what may. If there's a decision that's egregiously wrong and it's having these destabilizing effects and it's not workable, get rid of it. And nothing the dissent said could move that opinion. I mean, I really think the most important aspect of the Dobbs case is the majority saying we don't care what the liberals think. Right, we're not going right. to be swayed by these talks about legitimacy or court packing or the other concepts that people raise up. We're going to make our decision by our best lights. That's all we can do.
Yeah, I think that was an important stand to take too, in light of all the intimidation that went on after the leak. But you know, the other thing that struck me about this, Josh, and you mentioned this briefly, there wasn't a defense of Roe as a constitutional mm-hmm. right. There was not a defense of Casey that could stand alone from that initial grant by judicial activism. I mean, they didn't even really try. I mean, they did sort of like a cursory attempt to just sort of defend the Roe court. But after that, it was really about the utilitarian objections to what overturning Roe would mean, both in terms of how public policy would play out and in terms of what it might mean for some other cases in the stare decisis issue. And I was really kind of surprised. I was wasn't expecting to be convinced by this, of course, because I thought Roe was a terrible decision, but I was expecting more of an intellectual defense of it than what we got.
You know, there isn't much of a defense available. The most they can say is that abortions have been performed for as long as we have recorded history. Right? And at various times, various governments have taken different positions towards abortion. Maybe they've been permitted at certain stages, maybe they've not been permitted. But what you need to show is not just that it was perhaps permitted at certain stages or criminalized at certain stages, but that people spoke of it as a right. Did anyone ever, before the 1960s, say that there was a constitutional right to an abortion, that there was a right the government could not abridge? And the answer is emphatically no. The fact that some governments may have permitted abortions earlier in the pregnancy only gets you so far. That means it's okay, they permitted it, but they can ban it tomorrow, right? The mere fact that something is legal does not make it a right. And this is a very huge disconnect between the majority and the dissent.
We're speaking with Josh Blackman of Reason.com's Volokh Conspiracy. You mentioned, too, about the other cases, about how it might impact gay marriage, how it might impact some other cases. You know, Clarence Thomas wrote a very controversial concurrence about how he really wants to go after substantive due process. And Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence that said we are absolutely not going to be doing that. And Alito also said that in the opinion. And you have an interesting piece, the Kavanaugh concurrence is the new Kennedy occurrence. Before we go out to break, I got a couple of minutes. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by that and how Brett Kavanaugh's influence on this is going to, or may or may not serve as a limiting principle to what you can do after Dobbs.
Also in history, people might recall that President Reagan had three Supreme Court nominees. The first was Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman on the court. The second was Antonin Scalia, who was the first Italian-American on the court, who became one of the leaders of the court's conservative wing. And the third appointee was a little complicated. Originally, Reagan nominated Robert Bork, who was a very conservative judge, and the Democrats and some Republicans voted him down in the Senate. Reagan tried again with a guy named Doug Ginsburg, who got in trouble because he had smoked some marijuana with students. He had to step down. And then the third runner-up was Anthony Kennedy, who was a Ford appointee from California. And Kennedy proved to be a very moderate and, in many cases, liberal member of the court on issues involving gay rights. A lot of the decisions involving gay rights turned on Justice Kennedy's views. But even where Justice Kennedy was sort of a conservative, he'd often would write separately. He would say, well, I agree with the majority opinion, but here's some limitations. And he would sort of narrow the opinion. And I've noticed that Justice Kavanaugh, who clerked for Kennedy, does much the same. In a couple, maybe two dozen cases already, he just sort of writes separately, saying, well, I agree with the conservatives, but here's some of the things to think about. He did it in the gun case. He did it in the abortion case. He keeps doing it over and over again because he sort of just wants to moderate things. That's how he approaches the law. That's his M.O.
Well, it's interesting, and I think it's something to keep in mind. We're going to talk a little bit about Broome when we come back. We're talking with Josh Blackman from Reason.com's Volokh Conspiracy. We're taking your calls. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Bruin case. That's the gun rights case from New York that was also decided over the last few days. Very controversial case. Not, I don't think, a terribly controversial outcome. We'll find out after the break. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Your news.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Your news now.
The Relevant Radio studio line is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters, flexible premium life insurance. You know, for less than $12 a month, a 40-year-old can get $500,000 of coverage. Go to relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 49 minutes past the hour, and Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com filling in for Drew today, talking with Josh Blackman of Reason.com's Volokh Conspiracy. Don't forget, coming up next will be the Cale Clark Show, and the topic today is gas station screens and our distracted souls. Plus, how Jesus defeated Satan fair and square. That's going to be an awesome show. That comes up at the top of the hour, the Cale Clark Show, so stay tuned. And Josh and I have been talking, we spent most of the time talking about what went on in the Dobbs case that overturned Roe. Let's talk a little bit, though, Josh, about the Bruin case that was out of New York. Now, this was a case that involved the May issue permit law for carrying firearms in New York. And the court took this up. New York actually tried to change the law to make this challenge moot. The Supreme Court refused to moot it, which, again, I would say probably gave you an idea of what was coming. But then, of course, the final decision, they threw out the May issue law. And this will probably impact half dozen other states that have similar laws, but doesn't mean that states can't have permits for carry. For carrying, it just means that the burden of proof for denying the permit has to be on the state rather than on the applicant.
Well, sure. Thanks for having me back. 43 states have what's called shall issue carry. That is, if a person passes the background check and doesn't have any red flags, they're given a permit. New York and about six other states have what's called may issue. That is, the state may issue a permit if you show enough need. You have to show some sort of special justification for having a firearm. Now, why does this matter? It matters because in New York, most people who apply for it are denied it. Unless you're like special, you're a politician, or you're powerful, you're not going to get a gun. The Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment protects the right to carry a gun outside the home, and it can't be subject to that sort of discretion, that if you meet objective criteria, you get your permit. This was a big Second Amendment case, although it probably won't have a huge effect because, again, in 43 states, the law already permits shall issue carry.
Right. And again, I mean, this is it has had no real effect on those states because those states have a objective standard for approving those types of permits. If there's nothing on a person's record which violates some sort of prerequisite for the issuance of a permit, the state has to issue it. It's not at the whim of whim of a bureaucrat. Oftentimes, though, it's the local sheriff that makes those decisions, or the local sheriff.
Or even a judge. But still, the standard is purely discretionary.
Right. And you can't have a discretionary standard when it comes to an enumerated core constitutional right. And again, I mean, I think that the I read through the language on this. I thought that this was a fairly straightforward case. I thought that the opinion was fairly straightforward. The dissents on this really, I think, again, was more in the utilitarian sense. As well, you've got gun violence, you've got this, you've got that. And rather than saying maybe a little bit more to this, maybe a little bit more in Bruin than was in Dobbs, really, the dissents really didn't talk about the core constitutional issue of the right to bear arms. At least not that how I read it. How did it read to you?
Right. The dissenters basically said that even if there's some evidence of a right to bear arms, if the evidence is sort of, inconclusive, they should err on the side of safety, that you should defer to the government in this regard, and that you should not tell states that they're required to issue permits to people. So it was really about how much deference does the government get, and really, what's the historical basis for a constitutional right to carry a firearm?
So, again, I mean, I think it's an interesting case. I'm not. I think it was so straightforward, though, that, and really, this is the type of thing that we've hashed out a number of ways. It does, I think, though, tend to moot things that might be on the that might have been coming on the docket. Hawaii was one of those states, and there was a case that was really absolutely, and this is one of my favorite absurd cases, Young versus Hawaii. I'm not sure how much you've had a chance to look into Young versus Hawaii, but this is the case, a case where you had a may issue state and the Ninth Circuit upheld it because Hawaiian tradition prior to the adoption of the Constitution should have been, was prioritized in that decision, which I thought was rather a jaw-dropping construct, that there was that Hawaiian tradition trump the language of the Constitution. That's probably going to be just disposed of at this point in time.
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court will vacate that one like in the next couple of days, real quick.
Yep. So something to keep in mind. But there are other cases still waiting to come down the pike, right? I mean, I'm not sure if Josh that you're one of those folks like I am on decision release days at the end of a term, right, where you're looking for all the really interesting cases to come out. Where you're watching the live blogs, you're watching the things drop to the screen. But there's a couple of cases that are still left to be released. One of which is West Virginia versus EPA, which might be the biggest public policy case that they have left, and that's one that may end up having a great deal of impact on what the reach of the EPA is going to be. Have you been following that, and where do you think that that's going based on what we've seen so far?
Right. So this is the case involving climate change. The federal government hasn't really enacted new laws to restrict the emission of carbon. So instead, the Biden administration, and even before that, the Obama administration, have tried to use a Clean Air Act to restrict carbon emissions. And this was a statute passed in the 70s. And there's a question of whether Congress had intended a law to govern, like smokestacks and pollution, to reach the emission of carbon. And I suspect what the court will say is no, Congress, if you want to restrict carbon, you have to pass a new statute. You can't rely on these old laws from the 1970s. So this is a potentially a huge case for the regulatory community, not so much for individual people, but this is a case that businesses are very interested in.
Well, especially energy producing businesses, right? Because this is really aimed at energy producing businesses and, not just the coal industry, which is, I believe why West Virginia is involved in this, but, also the oil and gas industries, other industries where you have some sort of carbon emission that the EPA's self-expanded mandate here would then be able to control. I mean, this really is I think this is going to have a much bigger impact on commerce and energy than maybe people realize.
Right. This is a huge case, especially for energy-producing states, people working in the energy industry. But even more broadly, this could put a knife in the a government's regulatory power in general. That is, unless Congress enacts new laws that regulate specific items, then old statutes are not going to cut it.
And I think that's important too, because it's not just in this case, but and this is maybe a little bit of the portents of what may be coming in West Virginia v. EPA. Are the rulings that have come down on the CDC in terms of the eviction moratoria We haven't seen one yet in the mask mandate, but that's going to be that will be coming. It's going to the 11th Circuit right now out of Florida anyway. But the eviction moratoria case, I think, is really interesting in this regard, which is to say that they were very hard on the CDC for attempting to expand a line about their ability to control environments and say that they could expand that into other areas. This, I think, I mean, do you see that as maybe a signal as to where this is going? And do you expect to see that type of sharp rebuke to an expansion of past explicit statutory authority?
I do. I think what the Supreme Court's saying is that the executive branch can't rely on these sort of vague, nebulous statutes passed in the 70s to accomplish everything they want to achieve. That if there's some new problem, Congress must legislate for it. Even if you're doing a pandemic, right, you can't rely on authorities involving quarantines to impose mask mandates on planes or to impose eviction moratoria, right? These are not the sorts of laws that permit a sweeping change.
Josh Blackman, we're going to leave it there, but hey, West Virginia v. EPA, that might be coming out tomorrow, folks, so keep an eye on the Supreme Court. We'll see if my prediction and Josh's prediction rings true at that point in time. Josh Blackman, thank you so much for being with us. Stay tuned next for the Cale Clark Show. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. Have a great evening.